The Protect Your Neck Podcast, UFC 220 and Bellator 192 Breakdown. Picks, plays, and whatever else comes our way.
Hot air hangs like a dead man from a white oak tree. People sitting on porches thinking how things used to be. Dark night. It's a dark night. Dark.
What is up, you savages? This is the Protect Your Neck Podcast, and I am your host, Dan Tom, analyst whose work you can find at MMAJunkie.com, as well as find me 5 days a week on MMA Junkie Radio. But on this year's program, the Protect Your Neck Podcast, we focus on breaking down high-level MMA, and that's what we're going to do here as an expedited version. I think I have even broken my own record as far as late episode getting to you, as this is being recorded late Friday night, so who knows when you're listening to it, hopefully before the fights, hopefully Saturday morning realistically, as that's when it'll be up. It's been kind of a crazy week, just going to sum it up real quick. We'll jump in, get an expedited breakdown, UFC, then Bellator, but yeah, speaking of Bellator, yeah, it's been a crazy week. It's the first week where old Dan Tom's expanded duties are in play, which is awesome because we had a great main event, or at least we thought was the main event, right? The welterweight title fight between Douglas Lima and Rory McDonald. That gets moved to the co-main event. You can't see me doing air quotes, of course. Jackson versus Sonnen. I would have had to break it down anyways because it's the main event and also because it is part of the heavyweight tournament, the Grand Prix tournament that Bellator will be doing throughout 2018. So I'll be breaking down all those matches as well. But as far as Bellator goes, thankfully, not doing main cards as I won't really be covering that too thorough. Just kind of the headlining bouts, if you will. Chandler and then the two fights at the top, mainly. So that's kind of what you can expect as far as the expanded, content for Bellator goes. And of course, UFC, everything was for normal. You know, we had the main co-main event, main card came out. And as you're listening to this, hopefully the betting article, as I just submitted into the, editors, should come out, Saturday morning. Everything kind of got pushed back a day. Again, not only was it a crazy week, you know, we have the big card, of course, UFC 220, Bellator 192. But as you heard last time, I was dealing with some bunch of stuff, some health issues. Not even sure what I had sorted at the last one, but essentially looking at hiatal hernia and definitely umbilical hernia, and I'm already referred to for surgery. Was trying to get in this week, so it was kind of tentative. Like I wasn't even sure if how much work I was going to be able to get done this week. Even if I wasn't even sure I was going to be able to complete my content, but here I am, tooth and nail, down to the wire, getting content out for y'all. But, health comes first though, and everybody, thankfully, I work with awesome people and everyone's been very supportive, and you guys, listeners out there hitting me up, with your own hernia stories or remedies and stuff. Very helpful. Thank you. Thank you all very much. But yeah, I was in some really bad pain and discomfort. So aside from possibly trying to get into the surgery this week, I was also just, there's certain days where I wasn't sure if I was even going to make it into the studio. It's essentially just three levels of different pain. The hiatal hernia causes an insane acid reflux and pain in your stomach like no other. The umbilical hernia pretty much just rattles through your small intestines. So from left to right, your whole lower feels bloated. Just awkward, weird, just hurting, all these different things, your small intestine giving you the sensations. And of course, the umbilical hernia itself affecting the core muscles and abdominal wall, making your other core muscles compensate. So essentially from lower back, ribs, side to stomach to all around, physical pain. So three levels going on, not very comfortable, but I'm going to live. It's the lesser of evils, believe it or not. All's good. That's the update. Let's not waste any more fucking time. Let's get to the fights. We're going to start from the bottom. We're going to start from the bottom, and it's a play, so we're coming out hot. Prelims, I believe this is on FS1. It's going to be Yeah. FS1 prelims, Makhachev, -260 favorite versus Gleason Tibau, +220. I essentially have two recommended parlay pieces, which is, you know, again, I always play what I say, of course, as you know, as you listen, but the recommended parlay pieces, as explained in my article, they're just recommendations as far as my most confident picks that are within range if you're looking to parlay for fun, because, of course, there is no other way to parlay but for fun, because parlaying is a fucking madman's game. Betting is a madman's game for MMA. We know this, but we're degenerates anyways. So accepting this, yeah, that's my opinion. And the reason why that's my opinion for this matchup, though, is because not only the obvious, you know, layoffs, which, you know, can be weary, but, you know, you sought a suspension for a guy who, let's be honest, was a poster child for, you know, suspicious eyebrows, right? And I like Gleason Tibau, but, you know, let's be honest, right? And two, and it's kind of crazy, I had to dig back to my 2015 breakdowns on MixedMartialAnalyst.com, host of this here show, just to go back to, you know, Tibau's last fight, which was Abel Trujillo. But even, you know, in breaking him down and, you know, reviewing footage and just historically just kind of, you know, watching the sport and picking fights even before it being official, I've also had a pretty good read on Tibau, for better and for worse. You know, a champion, I think he's got like a very underrated game as far as the wrestling goes, not even just his jiu-jitsu, but his wrestling. I've talked about it here before, but, you know, I'll say it again because I recently rewatched it for the Khabib Barbosa study. But yeah, I feel that I would have scored and leaned toward a 29-28 toward Tibau in that fight. You know, I think I've even heard some people argue the 30-27. I mean, I feel like Tibau, at least to me, earned, as far as how MMA judges score fights, you know, earned it and was shutting him down. Even if he, you know, turn the volume down and don't listen to the commentary, who also thought Tibau won the fight against Khabib Nurmagomedov. And, you know, there are similar comparisons, you know, to their games, you know, like, well, Khabib had trouble, you know, getting Tibau down. And if Tibau was able to shut Khabib down, can he do it to Makhachev in theory? You know, styles, yeah, sure. You know, we see these, you know, Brazilian jiu-jitsu black belts with underrated wrestling shut down these Dagestanis, you know, fellow American top team teammate Adriano Martins. You know, kind of his highlight wins with of that, you know. You know, so you know, on paper, yes. But, you know, although, sorry, I don't know why the Japanese terms are coming to me, but although Khabib's kanewaza, you know, his takedown game is probably better than Makhachev's, obviously. Even though Makhachev is a really good takedown game, and that's what I'm going to be interested in. I'll get to that in a second here. But like I've said here before in this podcast, and granted, I'm, you know, warning, I'm a little bit higher on Makhachev than most, I feel, just because I really like his grappling style. And, you know, Dan's a hand fighting nut, and, you know, hand fighting is a lot of different definitions, but of course, how I usually speak to it, and I'm speaking to it in this term, as far as grappling, picking wrists, really beautiful stuff. I mean, you see it in his M1, and you see it, really, it's really, really does a really nice job, as far as you want something you can retrieve on Fight Pass, the Leo Kuntz fight. You know, when he goes to, obviously, to be not Leo Kuntz, but that's not the point. It's the technique we're talking about. But he goes to tripod up, and he just, you know, just some really simple stuff like picking a wrist. Like, again, wrist control or picking wrists just does so much, whether you're taking someone's base or balance or they're on top of you and you just want to isolate a wrist because, hey, if they don't have a wrist available to them, all their chokes are taken away and their passes are immediately destabilized, right? Okay. But... yeah, so I don't really see Tibau having a huge advantage in the grappling on the floor, the neiwaza, of course, if you're going back Japanese judo terms there, which I don't know why, because neither of these guys are Japanese or judo players. It's late. I'm sorry. But I definitely don't see him out-hustling Makhachev. And it's a southpaw versus southpaw matchup, which Tibau has struggled with in the past. Some of my earlier betting days, and maybe part of the reason why I'm high on Michael Johnson is because Michael Johnson came through as an underdog a lot for me back in the day, and Tibau was one of the bigger ones, and which was Tibau wasn't showing the signs of wear, which I was kind of alluding to earlier for this play, because even in the 2015 breakdown, you know, from suspect gas tank to weathered chin, Tibau was already showing these signs, and they were much more subtle back then. Like the Johnson call wasn't a popular one. I want to say he was like a plus 260 dog or close to the 300s maybe at a certain point. But yeah. So, I mean, these are kind of long trends for a guy that, again, I'm not hating on, you know, Makhachev's going to have to be careful and not that learn his lesson and, you know, Lentz didn't teach him anything, but Lentz's most success he had is he had a couple threatening leverage points, not so much submissions, but threatening leverage points because he's so good with the guillotine and front headlock and working from it. And that is one of T-Bow. I mean, he's got the rear naked choke finishes, obviously, but that's one of T-Bow's more underrated moves is the guillotine there. So anyways, Makhachev, that's it. That's the long explanation. Next fight, Barzola minus 245, Bissett plus 205. This was like up until 48 hours ago or so, whenever I did this study for this fight, I was really eyeballing strong, and I don't blame you for playing Barzola. I know my man Showtime from Tennessee, caller from Junkie Radio. That was one of the more safer plays in a parlay he was spitting at us, which it was. And again, I don't blame you for playing him. I mean, Bissett's only taking the fight on a week and a half notice. He was contemplating retirement, moving on. He's got his background plan set. But, you know, Bissett, if you really take the time, and it's hard because he's more experienced than you would think on paper. But that experience in those fights, at least for me, I had difficulty tracking down a lot of it. Now, granted, Dan likes to watch kind of everything he can, so that's kind of besides the point. There is more than enough to get a read on this fight, though, as far as Bissett's timeline. And I've seen him around before, but you know, just one of those guys that's never really stuck in my head. And he's decent, man, as far as stand up. You know, he knows what he's doing. I mean, he got, you know, first shot he takes, of course, from Hullabaugh on the Contender Series, and he's kind of on Wax Street. I couldn't find his other official stoppage loss, but aside from that, I mean, he moves his head well. He moves his feet well. You can see improvements. Really, he understands what he's doing in there. He doesn't have that threatening force as far as, like, making guys super scared in there, like that one-shot KO power. But he throws a lot of variety, and I really like how he works off of his lead leg. But what I think is, obviously, is his strengths in the ground. He can wrestle, man, but he's a black belt in judo, brown belt in judo, black belt in jiu-jitsu, I should say. But he can wrestle as well, so I think he's going to, A, be able to contend with Barzola, because obviously that was the main thing looking in. Because Barzola, I've criticized and I've underrated him, admittedly. But at the same time, there are certain things where I stand by where it's like, and that's the kind of thing where I pump the brakes. I'm like, wait, what the fuck is this guy really good at the end of the day? Like, okay, he's improving his footwork, he's improving his hooks, he's improving his kicks. Of course, heart, stamina, will, and just his story is amazing, and all those things make for just an indomitable willed fighter, right? I am definitely not doubting that, and that can take you a long way. Like I've never doubted that. I may have underrated that, but I've never doubted that he had that. Maybe I underrated that it would allow him to win fights, that it allowed him to win. But as far as pure technical skills, you know, there's nothing where you go, oh, Barzola does that fucking so great. And he is improving, and so I don't want to go back to shitting on the guy or anything like that, but so what I'm trying to say here is maybe this is the fight where we're reminded of that. You know, he is an overperformer, an overachiever, Barzola. But maybe this is a letdown spot. I mean, you know, it is a week notice. But he was training for a fight, Bissett was. Yes, but that fight was a long ways out. And, you know, what kind of shape is he in? But then again, Bissett isn't the biggest 145er. So maybe, you know, it isn't bad. Maybe they're meeting at a certain weight. But, you know, there's a story I read, and shouts to a colleague, John Morgan, up at MMA Junkie, about Bissett, who was thinking about retirement, but at the same time, within 18 hours of that conversation he had with his wife, has a conversation with Sean Shelby about filling in, and which is, A, a cool story you should go check out, but B, more in detail part of the story for nuts like me, why I kind of comb through stories as well as watch footage is, you know, Bissett was just saying, like, which I hear guys do, which are smart, they scout guys in their division, but usually they don't do it if they're not in the same organization. But I guess it makes sense that Bissett was doing it for Barzola because Barzola was a UFC fighter. But yeah, essentially, he was already scouting Barzola. and was looking at his game and thought that, in fact, of all the guys he was scouting in his division of potential fights, he thought that, A, they would make a great fight and that he was a well-matched fight for him. And I can kind of see why. And he wouldn't divulge his game plan, but he did go as far as to say that he specified two particular areas that just screamed to him and he's going to try to take. I think one of those is a guillotine with the way that Barzola reaches in. You go in for that many takedowns, you know, you're going to have your guard down on some of them, and he just hasn't run into the right guys, I don't feel. Obviously, he faced a good guy with a guillotine last time out, and Gabriel Benitez, and looked good. Because, again, I don't want to take... He looked good in that fight. I don't want to take away from Barzola. Like, he's improving every time out like he should. He should win this fight. But just the things Bissett was saying, and it almost felt like, you know, if you put Dan Tom in an actual, you know, capable fighter, you know, guy that commensurate skill level, like, and ask me those same questions, I'm like, okay, this is what I'm going to do to this guy. This is what I see. Da, 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 da. And that's what the vibe I essentially got from that interview with Bissett. And can he do it? I don't know. I don't fucking know, right? The odds seem about right. Again, you know, Barzola should win. But man, it was enough to scare me off. Just put it that way. All right, next fight. Wow, plays. There's not a lot of plays, but they're all early, I guess. So, knock on wood. Hopefully, just have a good night early, and just relax the rest of it. One of the only official dogs I took, and as you know, I put my money where my mouth is in that case. Dan Ige, my +120, -140. For Julio Arce, who is the deserved favorite. So, again, just like the Mads Brunel play, I don't blame you for not following me because, A, I don't know how popular of a dog pick it's going to be. Not that it should matter. It comes down to the analysis, your feelings, your personal choice, obviously. But no, and more importantly, the reason why I say don't follow so much is the Extreme Couture bias. And in this case, the Hawaiian bias. And I've only, you know, had a couple interactions personally, to be honest with Danny Gay. Again, my ass is my out of shape ass, I should say, is so busy that I don't get in the gym, and that's gonna definitely change. There's gonna be some lifestyle changes coming. I already had to kind of change my diet around with this hernia thing, and part of it in reducing symptoms is keeping weight down. Something Dan Tom was trying to do anyways to get back down to his fighting weight, and what better excuse than painful hell stuff? Anyways, neither here nor there. I'm not in the gym that much, so I honestly, people were asking me about Danny Gay and I like about, you know, inside stuff. Not that I give that out. Come on now, but anything like that, and you know what I thought, at least, you know, not inside like bad stuff, like you know what I mean. My thoughts essentially, and you know I really don't have too much, but you know he did come through when we had Gaethje in the studio. It was the last time I saw Dan, and I know he'd been working with Gaethje, one of his main guys, while he was out there, and that says a lot, you know, to be that guy's partner. And obviously, Gaethje probably needs himself some durable, tough partners like a Dan Ige, you know, guy who can wrestle, throw, and his stand-up's improving each time out. He's working a lot with Ray Sefo and other guys around town, I believe, too. I mean, this guy works hard, and you know, nothing to write home about, but for a wrestler who wants to pressure, it's exactly the kind of boxing set, primarily boxing set. He throw kicks, but primarily boxing-centric style, and he keeps his eyes open in the pocket. He commits. He commits down the pipe, down the center, keeps going forward, keeps his feet underneath him, but he doesn't retract back into the pocket and kind of hang out there, which is going to be really important because he's going to be facing a much better pocket boxer, at least on paper, in Julio Arce, who I really like. You know, I thought the line was a little crazy in the Contender Series, even though there really wasn't a lot of footage, just a lot of his striking and more of amateur and earlier MMA stuff. But I was like, wow, there's a lot of hype on this kid. But I like Tiger Schulman, the Team Tiger Schulman guys. So I wasn't questioning it too heavily. And again, you know me, I like my, you know, southpaw strikers, and especially ones who are well rounded. And this guy can transition and move. You know, you might not be the best wrestler, Julio Arce, but he's got the defensive chops and offensive chops when he needs them in transit, the small spaces. You can see that his head's in the right place, for the most part. You know, and as far as the jiu-jitsu transitions, once you're really getting on the mat, he is far from lost there. And again, I got to imagine working with guys like Jimmy Rivera and he himself just being active and pursuing grappling tournaments. You know, it's not just on his written resume. You can actually go find a lot of his grappling footage online too. So he's definitely going to be able to hang with you. It's not like Ige gets him to the ground and it's done. You know, believe me, it's not like that's not the path I'm saying. It's going to be a tough fight for Ige. And Ige is going to have to be, not be, I don't want to say, you know, lazy or but not lackadaisical in the scrambles. You know, because he's so good in certain areas and so confident with his defense. And I know that I'm kind of wired the same way, where you almost allow bad positions because you're so confident in reversing and defending and transitioning from them. But you need every inch you can at this level, no matter who you're facing, especially when you're facing a guy who's, you know, on paper supposed to beat you. That being said, you know, Arce, just that basic prototype, talented, young kid, well-versed, mainly striker, centric, loves his space, likes to get comfortable, right? He likes to get his rhythm before he gets going. He's not, for the most part, you know, you've kind of fight to your level, so and you be deceptive looking at earlier footage, but for the most part, seems to be a guy who likes to find his rhythm first before he gets going. So a pressuring, durable guy who can wrestle, handle his own, if not be better than you on paper on the ground, and still be durable and powerful enough to get your respect with the right kind of style to not hang around in your game, but get your respect in your game. Yeah, on paper, those are going to be the guys that give him trouble. Does that mean Dan Ige is going to beat him? I don't know. But I'm going to play it for a half unit. So that is the lone straight play, the lone dog pick. All right, next, Alejandro Pantoja, minus 130. Dustin Ortiz, plus 110. Big fan of Pantoja, you guys know this, and of course, I make the same Willow joke every time. If you don't know Willow, it's because I'm an old fuck, and you should go back to 1989 to go watch yourself some classics, because you'll see where Lord of the Rings kind of got its thing from, and Dustin Ortiz, I believe, makes a cameo in that movie. All right, but you know, Dustin Ortiz, in his credit, he has been making a lot of improvements, especially when he's been doing his camps at CSA, which have been inconsistent, and I think that actually goes with his recent win-loss ratio off the top of my head. I don't have it right in front of me, and I did this study a couple days ago, so forgive me, but Ortiz is and has been doing a decent amount of time, not just like a month like the one before, but spending a decent amount of time in California, not doing the home camp in Nashville at CSA, so which is going to be good because Alejandro Pantoja's Muay Thai is only getting better. He's still, you know, his aggression's always going to make him available to be hit. He's not as hit on his regional to RFA days. You know, he's still looping, but he's not like where he's like leaning with his chin forward and just throwing his uppercut like he was, you know, in the regional days. He's tightened it up a bit and, you know, it's kind of tightened up with his little Dutchie combinations. And I got to imagine that goes from working with, I want to say he's been working with Nova Uniao. Again, it's been a couple days. Nova Uniao, but I know for a fact, though, he's done multiple camps, including spending decent time with Henry Cejudo, who is no stranger to going down to Brazil. And they also share the same wrestling coach, the Eric Alazin, or I'm sorry, forgive me for not knowing. The funny-looking dude with the glasses that was on the MMA Hour probably a couple months or weeks ago. Dustin Ortiz can scramble, wrestle with, you know, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belts and kind of with some of the best of the guys. You know, you really kind of got to hurt him and be super opportunistic like a Brandon Moreno who specializes in that. That being said, Pantoja's a real another level, man. I'm really impressed with his Jiu-Jitsu. You hear John Gooden speaking about his hips against Neil Siri, and it's a great description because when I was doing the study for Pantoja for his fight with Shelton and going through his regional stuff. And I want to say it was his RFA flyweight title bout, but you see him kind of just splay and press his hips and kind of butterfly his hips out and just pressure his hips into the lower back of his opponent. The way he does it, like, there's just certain things that it's like, it's a move that it's essential to the position. Everyone has to do it. Everyone has their own version of it. Most of it looks the same to the naked eye, But there's these little details that really just make certain guys kind of just stand out. And that's definitely one of them. That's definitely one of them for Pantoja. So, I'm probably going to play him straight up at minus 130, but it wasn't something I could recommend for a straight play or anything like that. And, I feel pretty strongly about it, so even though I could see it being on the avoid list for some people, and again, I'm somebody who says it all the time, like the same way they say, oh, heavyweight fights have swings, well, in a different way, but in similar to volatility, not like knockout volatility, but as far as result volatility, flyweight is still similar because, you know, sample sizes are still tricky. I know I always abuse that word, and more importantly, all the guys are technical, all the guys are good everywhere. Which means momentum swings can be a little more more active. Yeah, hence, the pace of the fights go back and forth more, right? So that can always be dangerous. But for that, a guy I like, I may sprinkle a little bit on that. All right, next fight, Saba Homasi versus Abdul Razak Al-Hassan. It's a rematch from a month and a half or so ago. Quick turnaround, especially considering, you know, these guys blasted each other, more so Homasi got blasted for the most part, who is plus, probably why he's an underdog, plus 165, minus 190. It's been in the 200s. It's come down. I don't know if people just maybe kind of are sobering to the hype of Al-Hassan. I know I was guilty of it early. I corrected the steering wheel and kind of stayed away from this one for this fight. When they first fought, I should say. And I think it showed why, even though I picked Al-Hassan, and Al-Hassan was favored to win, and he was getting the better, I don't even want to say arguably, I think most people's opinion will say so, and was on his way to winning that fight, right? So there's nothing wrong with that, I have no disagreements there, but, you know, I was saying, you know, I don't think that, you know, Homasi was complete trash, like the initial, I can't remember what the initial line, but I remember the initial line, as well as, you know, overall opinions, Twitter opinions, community opinions, you know, not high on Homasi, and I don't blame you, you know, for not being, but I just felt that, you know, he's still a capable fighter, with skill sets. Sure, it's not a sharp samurai sword he's wielding, it's more of a, you know, Monoslavic caveman club, but you know, it's still a weapon that can hurt you, kind of a thing, and that was, I guess, the point. So I stayed away. But you know, if that line keeps dropping, I'll play Razak Al-Hassan, or I'm still kind of putting together some parlays. You know, I only do two or three for fun, and one of those is always my main card picks, which is a default play. But anyways, I still have one in the chamber that I'm playing with because just my kind of for fun one. Maybe I'll throw him in there. Who knows? I don't know. We'll see. But yeah, not much to say there. Kyle Bochniak, plus 115 in the next fight. Brandon Davis, minus 135. Boy, another reckless guy from the Contender Series. I learned my lesson on Matt Steamroller. How about all those people saying that? Steamroller. I wasn't exaggerating, huh? These things I say to stick in your head in the podcast, sometimes they come back through the force of the audience. Anyways, but there's another kind of reckless cat. It comes from the Alan Belcher camp. Leaves his chin up in the air, kind of like a more aggressive Eddie Wineland that throws just more volume and variety, though, and is just mean. And has a hell of a beard, a chin. And he moves his head well when he wants to. He really does, you know. When he does get tagged, he will kind of shore up and he'll move his head and slip and roll and throw a punch. I'm like, dude, you know how to slip, roll, and throw? Like, his economy of movement's actually pretty damn sharp when he wants it to be. But then he'll, like, go a stiff chin Eddie Wineland kind of hopping in and out. And you're like, what are you doing, dude? What are you doing? Hence why it's on the avoid list. But the pick is Davis, though. I am picking the Contender Kid Series. You know, another the reckless kid for the Contender Kid Series. And, you know, Bochniak. This is the spot where initially I was like, you know, this is where this guy could upset. Again, opinions aren't high on Bochniak, and I don't blame them for not being high. But, again, he's a capable kid. He's tough, which can keep him in a fight and might keep him in the fight long enough to maybe land his opportunity of a counter right hand, which I think he's going to be his best shot. I have to imagine he improved his wrestling after that demoralizing fight with Jamie Kennedy, Bochniak did. And, you know, just no matter who he was going to face after that, that was clearly a wake-up call for him. And then furthermore, this matchup calls for taking the guy down. You know, you got to take this wildcat down in Brandon Davis, right? So that's something to look for. That's probably why the line's so close, and that's why it's on my avoid list. All right, on that beat, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we will knock out the main card for UFC 220, as well as some of the main card matches for Bellator 192. Thanks for staying with me.
Cucarachas enojadas.
Right here on the Protect Your Neck podcast for the main card, UFC 220. Of course, we're going to get in a little bit of Bellator before we get out of here after that. Thanks for listening. You are the real dedicated listeners for what I'm probably giving of a only going to be a 13 or 14 hour window to listen to this probably before fight card time. So, all right, main card first fight, Thomas Almeida versus Rob Font. This is on the avoid list. Because I love this fight, and it's a close fight, and it's going to be a wild fight because Thomas Almeida, I think people are catching on that he is vulnerable. After the Garbrandt loss, obviously people can realize that. Not to bump my chest, but I did pick Cody against him. But that's also because I pick guys like Pickett against Almeida. And that, you know, might sound crazy, but, you know, again, loss is a loss, man. I'm not saying anything, but I don't believe I was too crazy for picking that because I saw the left hook in particular being live, and certainly it was, and we've seen the left hook has been a culprit. I think I've been proven right, at least on that. And that was a closer fight than people expected, and I think people remember when they look in the record and just see that he KO'd Brad Pickett, Thomas Almeida. Rob Font, guy I've always been high on. But then he makes these questionable decisions, man. So you don't know what you're going to get. Like, this should be a fight, even though Font he's more known for the uppercut, which I actually see having some play with Almeida's shelling defense. And he can throw a left hook, but it's not like the money shot for him, so to speak. He's more out, you know, working everything off the jab on the way in. And his check jab is really nice. You know, he's always attaching it on the way out for safety, throwing that check jab. Not a lot of guys do. We're getting really well trained, Rob Font is, but it's just, is he going to put it together? And, you know, against, you know, so far against the, you know, the Brazilian guys who have pressured him, Douglas Silva de Andrade is a dangerous striker, but he wasn't the same type of pressuring striker as Lineker or even Pedro Munhoz. And we saw what that pressure kind of did to Font. I'm not saying he struggles with pressure, he can't take the pressure, but, you know, it's something to be worrisome of when we have a Brazilian pressuring Muay Thai marauder in Tomas Almeida coming at him, right? So that is worrisome, but that's probably why the line is indicative of what it is. I actually wouldn't be surprised to see Rob Font get edges on a hometown scorecard by shooting late round takedowns, despite what happened to him in his last fight against Pedro Munhoz, because I don't see Tomas Almeida go for guillotines that much, although he's a brown belt in jiu-jitsu and probably much better, you know, even better than we've seen him last there. Because we haven't seen him there. Excuse me. We haven't got a lot of ground footage on Almeida in the last couple of years when you think about it. But he's definitely not the same type of grappler as Munhoz and not the same type of threat. He's really good at counter grappling and underrated wrestling. Almeida is, you know, he hustles his ass off to get back to his feet. And if he does go for leg locks, he's just using it to create a scramble, which is smart. And again, to get back to his feet, get back to his money and his bread and butter. So as much as I was looking for reasons to pick Font, and I was surprised people weren't burnt or scared away from him like I was, because I'm a Font fan and even I was scared away, but the line not saying so, because now it's finally minus dead even. It's been itching. You all been tickling and teasing and taking pieces from that font line, and now you guys got it to even. Good for y'all. Good luck to y'all. I'm staying away from it. Good luck to you guys betting either side, whether you're on Almeida or font. Again, love font, but the pick is Almeida. I think the pressure, volume, and variety will make the difference. He's the time off, I think, is good for a guy like Almeida and the way he fights. So I don't think that will hinder him here. That is the pick. Next fight, John Biante. Hey, John Biante. I never was a Jersey Shore guy or anything like that, but give John Biante his own reality show. I fucking watch it. That guy cracks me up, man. Minus 145 against, that's right. My favorite guy to fucking watch tape on, Francis Marbose. Bodow Boho. The boring Boho. The life. You can hear the fucking tone of my voice, how much I fucking loathe. Oh, do I loathe, listeners? Do I loathe watching me some Francis Marbose footage? It feels like your life is being sucked from you and you want it back. Like, it feels like I watched 20 minutes of his footage and I feel like I've lost 5 hours. And I'm like, where did it go? Francis Marbose, what did you do with it? And then he does his weird little dances and his weird little Ginyu Force fucking poses at the end of the fight. Like, look what I did. Ah, decision that I probably didn't win or deserve to win. Roar. And you're like, the fuck, dude? I'm sorry, it's like there's just some guys I don't even want to put Barzola again. Barzola is not in the Boho's category. I don't want to shit on Barzola. I'm gonna give Barzola his credit, but kind of like I was saying though, where you're like, some guys like, hey, what do you do good exactly? Well, there are actually some things Boho's does good, like sucking the life out of a fight and the viewers watching it. But there's some guys where it's just like when Bruce Buffer's calling them and they're doing their hand in the air, like, yeah, right? When they're getting an introduction, like, I always kind of have my own voice in my head hearing, like, my own narrative of what they're saying in their head, and like, or at least my own fucked up narrative of it. And for me, when Francis Marbose is getting introduced, like, he's just, like, I just see a guy going, yeah, I'm just here. I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know what I do well. I'm just here. That's where I'm at. And I'm just like, what the fuck do you do? Sorry, I am not articulating this well at all because that's just how much this guy fucking maddens me. Boho's could absolutely, back to the technical stuff. All right, sorry, I'm getting lost. It's late. Boho's makes me very angry. And by the way, obviously this could be sprinkled because there's a play attached, which is kind of dangerous with how emotional I am to this, right? So fair warning as far as the emotional bet goes. But it's honestly what my eyes see, and if you go back on my notes on what these guys do well and what they're open to, the puzzle pieces fit. So I'm not drawing from thin air here. The line is close. It probably should be, but again, maybe it's me being emotional. I was surprised it was this close. Not enough for a straight play, but I played Viante by TKO plus 209. He's known for his right hand. He throws an underrated left hook, but his uppercut is money. And that's been a shot that has troubled Boho's in the past. The way he keeps his guard, the way he dips, and the way he will be dipping because the dynamic of this fight calls for a takedown. And, dude, Viante's corner, Belmore Kickboxing Academy, and Hav Wyman here, they're very good. It's not them. It's Viante's fucking propensity to just face block because he's just such an offensive first fighter. And he just face block. He's the master of the face block. He blocks with his face. But, they call for jabs when they're facing guys like that. They know are going to take him down, like when in his fight against Patrick Cummins. They're calling for uppercuts, So I believe the game plan is going to be there. And his takedown defense is there. I mean, he's top three in the division for a reason at 92%. Boho's is fucking awful with fucking 20-something percent because he just presses against the cage the whole fucking time. And when he does get on top, at least in the UFC, has not been that dominant. Like, he's been able to control for decent stretches, but not very well. Even in, his last fight against, Reiki, I think it was, against the fucking striker, he almost, has a mount for a second against the cage and then just gets shucked off. Like, a total rookie move, where you're just fucking, you're just chasing treasure, jumping for the back too eagerly, like a white belt, and, just getting literally shucked forward with such little effort. Fucking white belt move and a rookie move, and he is not a white belt, nor is he a rookie. So again, just what the fuck are you doing here, Bohos? Hopefully the TKO prop cashes. Not so much so it cashes, but just so the UFC. I never want to wish out. I sounds terrible. I'm sure he's a nice guy. I wish him the best. But I don't wish to fucking break down his fights anymore. I don't see what the fuck he... Well, it's a fucking light division, so he's going to find a home. He's probably going to have a longer leash than most. But goddamn, I mean, I can't think of a moment this guy's offered. And the fucked up part is that you go to his record and his fights, you know, regionally before he got to the UFC, the dude had, like, all finishes. So you're like, wait, well, Dan, you know, he had, like, no, that only strengthens my fucking point. He had all finishes. The fuck, dude? All right, it's late. This is supposed to be an expedited version, and we spent too much time talking about a fucking fighter that I can't stand. All right, next fight, Shane Burgos, a fighter that I love, -210 versus Calvin Kattar, a fighter who I've grown to really, really appreciate and really like, which is probably why this fight, oh, Calvin Kattar, by the way, +175, comeback, why this fight is on the avoid list because of my respect for Kattar and the deceptive difficulty he's going to bring to this matchup, just like he did to the Feely matchup. Yeah, man, it's weird because, you know, his sample size is just such a weird one. It's such a weird one, Kattar, you know, because he took time off for a gym, injuries, was one of those young guys, kind of like a rest in peace, Josh Saman, where he's running, I believe he was doing some promotional work as well. Kind of stayed in the regional scene, you know, the Boston regional scene, so you're just like kind of like the, you know, Rogan talks about the old Boston comics where they stay in their scene. It's like, okay, they were legends, but they kind of just stayed in their scene and played to their crowd. So how good were they? I kind of applied that theory, which is why I tempered them and stayed away. You know, shouts to anybody that was on him against Feely. I'm pretty sure you got a good number on him. But yeah, dude, so this was this tricky sample size, right? You weren't sure. But then looking back at his footage, or I should say when you go look back at his footage, oh, sorry, my stomach. Excuse me. Oh, fuck. I probably got picked up on the mic. Oh, my stomach just growled like crazy. The dude is just, I really like his style, his fundamentals, and his awareness in the pocket's really sharp. He has that style where he'll jab. He'll do like that kind of initiation jab to kind of initiate like a flint lighter. He'll jab like a flint lighter just to spark an exchange. And when the guy throws back, he has this kind of step back like check hook. It's so beautiful. Even though the left hook is Burgos' money punch, I could see Kattar's left hook playing trouble with the angle that he throws it at. Whereas Burgos is a little more predictable because he's usually capitalizing on it. He's often leading with his right. You know, Burgos has that low-handed style where he's faint baiting you, wants you to throw, and he's going to throw over the top. Whereas Kattar is baiting you a little more fundamentally with his hands up, plotting with a jab. So again, you kind of got this really interesting clash of styles, and I can understand why the Burgos low hands makes people, uncomfortable, because it should inherently, right? It does. I mean, I don't particularly like it, but I understand it because, again, more of a boxing centric style, more of a minority style in general, right? But I get it, and when your eyes are open, and you know what you're doing, and you have good head movement, and I'm not talking about the good head movement when he's slipping and dipping the punches, which he does have, because you can counter to that, and rightfully so, by saying, but he gets hit a lot too, and that's true. But I'm talking about the head movement when he gets hit a lot. That's the head movement Dan Tom's talking about right now. It's rolling with the punches, that old saying. And when your eyes are open, and you see the shots, that, you know, science can be a little sketchy to a certain extent there, but that can take it off a bit. But not just seeing the shots, more so rolling with it. Now you're getting more into the physics of it. Now you're really kind of taking some steam off the shots. And Burgos does that. You got to know what you're looking at, but he does a pretty good job. Can he get taxed? And will he get taxed if he keeps doing it? Sure. Sure as shit. And I hope he doesn't, because Burgos, especially earlier, he was more known for his submissions. And I know I've said this before, I'm breaking down his game, but if you go to his earlier fights regionally, more known for his submissions, and he had really good wrestling, you know, really good wrestling. Again, you got to attribute this training guys to Jimmy Rivera and his stablemates at Tiger Schulman's, not just strikers there, right? And even in practices, apparently, you know, he was able to get Jimmy Rivera down, which is impressive. You know, oh, well, they're two different weight classes, and Rivera is a short bantamweight, whereas Burgos is a huge featherweight. Granted, but that makes it even harder, those short, stout guys to take down. So if Burgos is able to, you know, do that, that may serve him well here, because I think Qatar may be looking to do that. I think Qatar may be looking for those late-round takedowns. I don't even want to say maybe, because he consistently does it throughout his career. That's one thing. Even when he was a little more wilder in his earlier days, Qatar, he was still shooting for those late-round takedowns. And he transitions well. He'll pin wrists, and I love it. He, like, puts his hips and upper body into punches, but I just don't think he's going to secure those positions on Burgos if he... if he even gets that far down the road. I think this one is mainly going to contest on the feet, where I think Burgos is going to land the more meaningful shots. And I think unless Qatar can seriously take him off his game or hurt him in the first, then I think Burgos' pressure is going to build. So I picked him, but it's on the avoid list. All right, Ozdemir plus 280, Cormier minus 340. Again, I got an in-depth breakdown on this. If you miss any particulars, this is Cormier is a parlay piece for obvious reasons. I don't really feel like I have to break this one down too much. I will say, and I've always said this, Ozdemir underrated wrestling. I'm starting to hear that echoed more now, finally. But this is something your boy's been saying for a minute. You know, you really go look at and watch, you know, the way he fights hands. And that Kelly Adamson fight, obviously, that's the glaring hole. And that is the path to victory for DC. But I also don't condemn Volkan for that performance, though. I don't condemn him, because you look at before, or after especially, but even before, there's a lot to like about Volkan's game as far as the clinch and counter wrestling goes. I don't think it's going to be enough. It's going to be too much too soon. But if Volkan lands that punch, can we really be surprised? You know, can we really be surprised? I think the line's just, I'm all DC, I'm all in. He's a parlay piece, granted. So this might be, you know, hypocritical in nature, but I guess we couldn't be surprised if Volkan gets it done. All right. Main event, Stipe Miocic, plus 160. The champion is a dog to the challenger, Francis Ngannou, minus 185. This fight's kind of silly. Like, you could pick either side. And it's kind of silly because people, like, it's one of those either-or things. It's got that Conor Nate feel or whatever feel where it's like, either way, like, you could love one guy to death and pick against the other guy and reluctantly pick against them and be fair about it and lay out fair points on both sides. You know, like I often do in these breakdowns. And if Stipe wins, you're going to be accused of, you fucking wrote him off. Oh, you wrote him off. Everybody wrote him off. And just like, it's going to be a whole lot of I told you so, no matter who wins here. So that is not, that I'm not looking forward to at all. But the fight itself, oh, I'm fucking looking forward to this fight. I'm looking forward to this fight, and it really doesn't matter who you pick. The narratives are obvious. You know, I don't want to fucking broad blanket and say people are writing Stipe off. But yeah, you know, guess I was a little surprised, and Stipe was my early lean. I've said it on here in many places, and was looking, you know, not that I go into looking to pick anybody, obviously, I'm good about that, but, you know, fuck, I can't say that I wasn't looking hard, you know, and being surprised that, you know, oh, man, not liking what I see. And essentially, Stipe, yes, you're looking on paper. He's more experienced. He's fought better guys. He fought the same guys when they were better. He has more ways to win. And you want to look at it from that point of view. Sure, sure, sure. Yes, but the problem is Stipe's pressure, even when he does use his takedown game, which he doesn't use a lot, by the way, folks. And I'll get to that in a second. But to even get to his takedown game, much less his striking game, it all revolves around pressure. Pressure inherently makes you hittable, and Stipe has always been a pretty hittable guy. Not the most best defense, because he's, again, more of an offensive first fighter. Not to the extent of his buddy John Vellante, but yeah, he's an offense first. And so you look at that, his history of being hit, you look at the sheer speed difference, and I just that's what it comes down to for me. I can't get around it. Sorry, I'm just really uncomfortable. Just the symptoms are fucking killing me right now. 1 second. All right, I'm back. Sorry, I had to let that pass. My fucking body is just fucking breaking down on me. I can't even finish a fucking sentence because that's too much to ask. The easiest part of my week. I'm sorry. Dan Tom's a little frustrated. For those who've been following, know that in the past year, that anytime there's an important fucking week, whether it's an important week off that I need to use to get ahead, or an important week just full of important stuff, work-related, everything fucking possible in Dan Tom's life will just start going crazy. Stuff that I can't control. And it's just very, very frustrating. Especially when these things just happen at the worst times. You know, again, taking a vacation and just, and now the busiest week of the first quarter. It's just, it's number one bullshit. For sure, number one bullshit. When I work so fucking hard. All right. Frustration aside. What it comes down to is, what it comes down to is essentially, Ngannou's counters and his speed and the way he counters inside the pocket. You look at that Orlovsky fight. I mean, you look at all his fights, but it was just, for example, that Orlovsky fight when he throws the left, his money punch, that left shovel hook, but he misses. And because I was like, because to me, I'm like, what if he misses on that? That was one thing I was, a tendency I was seeing from his, from Ngannou's early footage to his relevant footage to his recent sparring footage. All three things in the time span, there was one similar tendency, and it was whiffing on the check hook. He throws great when he's punctuating off that shovel hook slash uppercut, right? But when guys are kind of coming at him and he's kind of in playful stick and move mode, Ngannou will kind of overthrow his check hook, and it's kind of got a low swinging tree vine retraction that I like to call it, because it's, you know, like Jens Paul versus, when he's commentating BJ Penn versus Dan Thomas, those long arms miss. Long arms are great, but when you miss big. And not only that, when it punches like a check hook, something that really accentuates a long swing, there is room to come up, and when you come up over the top, bad things can happen. You know, Luke Rockhold's a guy that puts a lot of swing into his check hook, right? And if, you know, we saw with Bisping, if you get the right angle, you can kind of return from your, retract your check hook and return right into harsh weather like Luke Rockhold did. So Stipe, with his feints and his battering ram right hand, his, you know, Klitschko quarter or whatever, where he gets off to the side and goes over the top, that was kind of the path as far as the standing path goes for Stipe. Obviously, there's a ground path, which we'll get to. But so I thought maybe he could come over the top that way. But in the Orlovsky fight, you see him miss with the left. But then when he comes and he does that kind of the shovel hook uppercut thing, but he does it with the right, right? And it's crazy because if you look at his feet do like a pivot where he's like facing one way and... But he adjusts when he misses the shot and Orlovsky goes under his left. You see his feet point from the right to his feet almost all pivot in unison to the left as his right uppercut shovel hook is coming at an insane speed, an odd angle again where, you know, Brian Sand points out where, you know, he's almost punching across his body. So he's not even getting the full power but still lifts Orlovsky off of his feet. And just, you know, the odd angle, the accuracy, the time that he had to do it, and the fact that fundamentally his body was still trying to and doing a pretty damn decent job of adjusting on the fly. And it's that little space that spoke loud enough to me to overcome the quote-unquote more paths to victory that Stipe has. Because, again, to get to where he wants, he has to travel through a really fucking sketchy neighborhood. And he's got a bunch of bling on going through that neighborhood, and he doesn't have the greatest security system on that car. It's a nice car, it can perform really well, but it's not the hardest to break into, and he's going through a really bad neighborhood. Boy, was that a racist analogy with the way this fight was going? Jesus Christ, I did not mean it that way. Holy shit, Jesus, Dan, boy, political sensitivity. I haven't caught up with everything this week, by the way. I try to stay out of that politic bullshit, but yeah, from what I'm seeing, it's been really disappointing, by the way. And it bums me out about MMA fans if people really make it about that. I'm trying not to read into the crowd's cheering or if it's, you know, for this or that. Both guys have awesome stories is what it comes down to, but I will say for anybody, you know, shitting on Ngannou's story or questioning why he would have an opinion. By the way, I'm not in the political BS when I say that. I do mean that, but I also 100% have no issue. In fact, side with Ngannou on what he said about his opinion on our Presidente Trump. So for what that's worth, I don't disagree with the man. And in fact, that's what I'm kind of talking about. That kind of bummed me out. That you know, just reading certain comment threads and just seeing the general population's comments makes me shake my head at MMA fans. But both guys have beautiful stories. So even if you feel like Stipe is being written off, there's no reason to be hating on Ngannou, folks. Okay, like it really, Stipe. I'm picking Ngannou, but I'm rooting for Stipe to win. And if Ngannou loses, he's not going to lose a lot of stock. Like he'll be back. Like, and if Stipe loses, he shouldn't lose a lot of stock either. Sure, that'll be a sour taste not hitting the record. But the dude's one of the best heavyweights ever, no matter what happens, you know, Saturday. So this whole one side or the other shit or, taking political issue shit, like, relax, people. Like, fucking relax. It's a great fight. These are great dudes. should be no issue here. Okay, before I go to Bellator, I'm just going to do a quick recap on the plays, which my article will drop. Should be up when you're listening to this. Okay, fantasy. I didn't talk about fantasy the whole time. Sorry about that. Shout out to my man, Jordan Fiegelman, though. Our local fantasy specialist here on the Protect Your Neck podcast. I don't know why I said it like that, but whatever. Daniel Cormier, I took at the top. Obviously, takedowns is the dynamic. He's at the top for a reason. I was able to fit him in. So I did. I did take Abdul Razak Al-Hassan as the next highest for 9,000. Again, it's going to be a firefight. I'm going to take the guy who is favored to win that firefight and get the finish and score you points. And the guy who, since we just saw the fight play out recently. Yeah. I'll take that guy. Gian Biante, obviously taking the TKO prop, which means I think he's going to score big. So I'm going to put my money where my mouth is in that sense too. And I got Gian Biante for 8,800. Brandon Davis, it is on the fights to avoid list, sure, but of course the fights to avoid list almost always end up on your DraftKings list because you're going to need your dogs and or wild cards in this case because he's not a dog, but it's a close enough fight and it's a wild enough fight. And again, it's going to be a wild fight, but I'm going to want to side on it even if it's not the most finish producing fight because again, these guys are lower weight fighters, right? But still, this guy goes for it. He puts the volume out there. So if Bochniak can't stop him, Davis should not only get you a win, but should at least put some significant strike numbers out there, if not maybe a late finish, because Bochniak's tough. All right, and again, putting my money where my mouth is, got to go, from when looking for dogs, go with my one and only dog pick, Dan Ige. Not only is my one and only dog pick, but the dynamic of him winning involves pressure and takedowns. So hopefully, not only can he can win, but if he does win, he will likely be scoring some points in the process because the takedowns will score you some points. And of course, got to go with Stipe Miocic. Of course, I officially picked Ngannou, but Miocic, I didn't touch on the ground part, sorry. Even though he doesn't shoot the doubles that he's probably going to need to, which is the reason why I picked Blades over Ngannou, that and also it was an underdeveloped Ngannou at the time. Miocic doesn't do those. He's more of a snatch single guy, which means he's going to have to be in range for harsh weather. And I don't know if he's going to get those because Ngannou appears to have some insane balance. So, and of course, in the clinch, does not appear to be weak there. His underhooks and fundamentals, fueled by his sheer strength, look like it may pose some problems. Not that Stipe can't get him down. The problem is, will Stipe be able to hold him down? Stipe has not traditionally been a controlling grappler. Even in fights where he was getting tagged, he was reluctant to at first, like the Shane Del Rosario fight. I mean, the Shane Del Rosario fight and the Mark Hunt fight are really the only two fights where Stipe took things to the ground and used that to finish in his whole UFC career. So again, kind of overblowing the wrestling here. And furthermore, the reason why he was able to finish is because he's got a good half guard. He didn't believe in it. It took him a couple rounds to believe in it. He actually took Shane Del Rosario down, who was icing him up with the kicks on the feet, but didn't believe in it till the second round, where he established his fundamental half guard, where he gets the opposing cross hook control and uses his free arm to elbow. That's what he did to Mark Hunt, the same move. He was much more confident, fought very smart with the Mark Hunt fight. But after that Mark Hunt fight, he was supposed to fight Ben Rothwell. And I took him against Ben Rothwell for a multiple of reasons. Who was on a run. Ben Rothwell was actually on a run that time, if you remember. But then Stipe pulls out for a back injury. And we haven't granted the fights. All of his fights have ended first round knockouts. And so how much grappling are we going to see? But We haven't seen him try to pursue any grappling since. And his grappling trends, even before the Mark Hunt fight, were going down. Again, he didn't use it as much as we like to think, right? And so you think you hear guys, athletes, older guys, heavyweights, fighters in general, he checks all those boxes that I just mentioned, have back problems. Fighters, whether they're wrestlers, just mix in wrestling, or just had a healthy amount of wrestling in their game when they get older in their career, what do we see, guys? We see guys stop shooting, right? So what I'm essentially trying to say is, one of my canary in coal mine theories is, you know, is it back issues causing these guys not to shoot anymore and shoot takedowns? And that's a theory I've kind of had with Miocic. And this is going to be the fight that tells us, because not that if he, because he could still get him down and still fail the fight, but as far as where Miocic's at, like, if he still loses the fight and goes for takedowns, I'll still be happy, because I'll be like, okay, cool. The guy still mentally knows when to shoot for takedowns, which is a good sign for a fighter. And B, his back is still allowing him. But until I see that, that is still a looming question. And again, being able to control Ngannou, because Stipe, again, has traditionally just been an awesome floater, awesome positional rides and ground and pound, but conservative and reluctant to do so, right? So unless he establishes that half guard, which I emphasize in my breakdown, he has to emphasize that the half guard is going to make the difference between Stipe Miocic winning and losing this fight. Mark my words, it'd be the half guard. Unless, of course, he clocks him with a right hand. Yes, it's heavyweight, obviously. Because Francis Ngannou, not only is he strong, freakish, and has decent get-up ability, but, you know, even from his... he has good techniques there. He understands underhook get-up, and he's understood what underhook get-up was far before, even not far before, his career's not that long, but before he got to the UFC. He's hitting underhook get-ups both against the fence, in the open, when he's inside control. And now that he's getting better at that, plus his obvious freakish strength where he can kind of just stand up on most guys. And Stipe doesn't have the submission game to A, threaten slash use submission threats to close off these escape routes. Like, for example, guillotine with the underhook getup, you know. He doesn't take obviously, you know, Stipe doesn't take it back. I definitely would fucking... not expecting to see him do that. It's not like he's going to take his back, right? So Ngannou can turtle up to stand when he wants to. So essentially, Ngannou's get-ups are going to have a lot of play. You have to go to a half guard. Now, against smaller guys, against certain stylists, especially someone like myself, you don't want to go to a half guard, because I'll create a scramble all day. Smaller guys will create scrambles all day. But heavier guys don't necessarily create scrambles from half guards. In fact, that's why, you know, again, the old Randy Couture reference there, but that's why Goldberg beat that to death. Because it was true, Randy knew that if I get to these bigger guys in half guard, the bigger guys aren't as mobile. I can pin the bigger guys down here. You know, it's a backwards, it's a weird backwards idea. You know, you'll take mounts and back mounts anytime you can get it. The guys are taking each other's mounts and back mounts in lower weight classes all the time, right? You guys don't have to be grapplers to know this. Think about it, right? But when we're in heavyweight, and at least smart commentators will point this out, and this is a very true fact. You'll hear him say, oh, he might not be wanting to risk it, and he's gonna dump off to side mount instead of taking mount, which is true. I'll do the same thing. If a guy's big and strong, you know, I love half guard, and I love my half guard sweeps, and I like the old Damian Maya push the knee down, and you kind of slide to a three-quarter, and you're in mount. But then all of a sudden, if I'm on a big, muscular guy, I don't like where I'm at so much. If my guillotines, my mounted guillotines aren't there from the mount, or my rear naked chokes aren't there, I'm not getting to his back like I want to, then I'm going to hop off to a side mount and work from there, because I'm going to feel much more in control. Because especially these big guys, they can just sit up from these certain positions. So it gets really tricky, man. So it's not going to be as easy as I think people are making it out, that Stipe has wrestling and Ngannou's not as proven as Stipe there, because I think both of those statements are not inherently true. I think Ngannou is better than we suspect, and I think that though Stipe is better than Ngannou, clearly I'm not arguing that. Maybe a little overblown, and if you really dissect the techniques that I just talked about. All right. Sorry, back on track to recap. That takes us to the cap, $50,000 for the fantasy team. Parlay pieces were Daniel Cormier, -340. Islam Makhachev, -260. Props, Vellante by TKO, +209. Half unit. Dan Ige, +120 is the only straight play. Half a unit. Avoid list is Bochnak, Davis, Almeida Font, Qatar, Burgos. Bellator 192, essentially. Jackson, Sonnen. People were commenting, like, why are you breaking this fight down? This broke down from freaking years ago. And I get it, man. I get it. I'm not hating on the, even on the hater comments, I'm not hating on. I get it. But no, I gave these guys my respect. And to be honest, it was really fucking fun going back in time. Especially watching the early Pride fights. Like, it felt like I was, like, my early fandom days again. So it was really fun, you know, going back and watching early stuff. Even some of Chael's earlier stuff was fun. You know, the first fight I became a fan of Chael was fighting WC against Brian Baker. In his post-fight interview, this was awesome. You know, I will fight any man God created. But yeah, I just think that the size will be the difference. Rampage, not looking as bad a shape as some may feared. Chael a little heavier than he projected to be. And I think the size is going to be the difference. Rampage, say what you will. More used to the frame, even though he's less mobile and less impressive at this weight, at this stage of his career. But even at this weight, at this stage of his career, through all stages of his career, Rampage has always come to fight. And that's what's going to make the difference. But I think it's going to be a decision unless he gets a dominant position early and uses that ruthless ground and pound. Douglas Lima versus Rory McDonald. This was a fight that I was excited, really excited to break down. I was looking for a lot of reasons to pick Douglas Lima. Not literally, of course, when I say that, but just I'm a fan of Douglas Lima. I think he's very underrated. I picked him against Lorenz Larkin. I wanted to pick him here. I am rooting for him here, believe me. I am 100% rooting for him here, but unbiasedly, the pick is the Red King. Just the wrestling is the difference, you know. Lima on a healthy knee to Lima not on a healthy knee. The takedowns have been there for opponents and against opponents who, at least on paper, aren't as good as McDonald. And McDonald shown even getting better as far as takedowns. I mean, he kind of leaned just a lot on his power double, which was amazing. And he was just freakishly strong, could suplex guys from a body lock. So he had the kind of point A and point B down of the spectrum. But granted, it was Paul Daly, but just the fact of the way he just smartly does the single leg snatch and the chain off, like, he didn't necessarily do that. I mean, he had some of those before where he would chain off and turn corners. Like, he could turn a corner. That wasn't necessarily new, but the way he kind of snatched it up and chained it, again, just kind of just showing the diversity that is Rory McDonald. It was so almost overstated in the beginning of his career as far as how well-versed. He's the new breed of, you know, mixed martial, well-rounded, but man, he really is now. Now he's really personifying that, which is why, you know, he might be cursing himself by looking ahead, but I will say, which is why a fight with Gegard Mousasi, even at middleweight, would just be awesome. But yeah, I think McDonald takes it. I think it's going to be by decision, possibly a late stoppage, if he can cook and wear down, get enough damage, because we haven't seen it as much lately, but Rory had that life-changing ground to pound, especially early in his UFC career, where it was just like Mike Pyle and other guys, where you just would hit guys, and the fight would change. You're like, what the fuck is he doing to these guys while he's down there? I didn't play it because, again, the line only kept creeping high. Now it's like, you know, higher minus 200s for Rory, which is parlay and region, and I'm rooting for Lima anyways, so I just kind of left it alone. I did sprinkle, though, on the other fight I'm really going to talk about on this card, which is Chandler inside the distance, plus 175. I put a half unit. Obviously, you guys know I'm boys with Chandler. Yamauchi's underrated, man. He keeps fucking proving people wrong. He beat my boy Ryan Couture, so my other friend Chandler, my former, you know, Extreme Couture alum back in the day when he was there, and even out, I went out to Alliance because, you know, we share the same coach. This is an emotional pick is what I'm trying to say, guys. So don't follow me if you don't want to there. Don't blame you. Be careful. Could get upset. Who knows? I don't know what Chandler's doing these days, man. I don't want to read headlines, but this whole not wanting to fight for a title or a rematch kind of confuses me. I got to catch up on what's going on with that. But he is, you know, training with the right people. I like who he's training with. You know, he's training with the right kind of coach. Henry Oof, pressure fighter. He's a natural pressure fighter. Should train with a pressure fighter. He's going to give him, you know, buckle down his fundamentals that he got away from when he was at Alliance. You know, he started fighting with his hands down and taking way too much damage. That was that period because he got away from Gil Martinez, who did really well. They worked really well together. And Gil Martinez was the guy who he started with in the beginning of his Bellator run. And by the end of his Bellator run, was outstriking Pitbull Brothers and holding his own with Eddie Alvarez there. So, but yeah, so that's my pick there. And of course, I went with just the chalk, you know, Pico and Jarjanian. So that's about it. All right, I'm gonna get out of here. It's already an hour and 10 minutes, and Jesus, you have to be fucking dedicated to be fitting into this window. Thank you so much. Thank you for listening to me complain. Sorry about that. Getting a little pissed off and emotional. It's just your boy's just dealing with a lot, and not including the literally 80-plus hour weeks that I turn in every week to provide y'all with content. Not trying to book it all. I'm doing it for you guys. It's the best fucking job in the world. I fucking do it for myself. I love this job. It's not what it's about, but what I am saying is it's been a hard week for your boy. So thank you for bearing with me. Thank you for your patience. I apologize for the late content. But again, that is another reason why all this stuff will always be free and in depth for you. And I appreciate the fuck out of you guys, especially times like this, and your little kind messages and all that shit. It really means a lot. Thank you very much. Best of luck to your plays. Enjoy Bellator 192. Enjoy UFC 220. And always protect your neck.